broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, guys. It's a bit of a split broadcast today with Joel and Steph reporting live from Coffs Harbour and Louis and Brett in Melbourne. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
The evolution of the podcast from the little office space to our little studio to now spread all across the place.
Hopefully not like coronavirus.
We're just like a virus.
We are a bit like a virus. Well, Melburnians are considered viruses in New South Wales, so we've got to keep a low profile here.
Yeah, who would have thought? We're not welcome.
First-hand experience.
Pretty much.
Yeah, a little bit like that. A little bit like that.
I have I've heard that there is a record number of people changing over Victorian plates to New South Wales plates.
Well, I don't blame them, do you? Given our numbers.
No, I can't understand why. Although New South Wales is starting to catch us a bit with that Crossroads Hotel scenario.
Yeah, and it was us that did it.
Yeah, well, let's not go too far into it then.
On a good note, though, I mean, you guys got to watch the football last night. I mean, Joel was very excited to watch Collingwood actually win for a change.
In front of a crowd, too.
Yes, I know. Can pull a crowd, mate. Can pull a crowd. 22,000 people in WA.
Yeah.
And amazing that the AFL could actually pull off the feat of keeping the season going. Under the circumstances, I think it's just amazing. Did they dodge a bullet by getting everyone out just in the nick of time? Or did they plan it, or were they ready for it? Or maybe
They were ready. Yeah. They had so many different contingencies lined up. The amount of planning they've been doing for months, they had all of these things worked through that they just needed to pull the trigger when they saw the right course of action.
Do you reckon they got an extra day notice?
I don't think they did.
Not necessarily.
They just foresaw it?
They foresaw all the variables, and they've been talking with health organisations, government, day in, day out. Like, they've constantly got some of their executives on the phone, so they're constantly updating their plans, and then as soon as they got the indication of where things were going, they executed their plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go.
Interestingly, though, when we got to New South Wales, the Premier decided to overturn the rule. We arrived on the 6th of July, and then by the 7th, they decided that anyone that had entered on the 6th of July would need to go into a mandatory quarantine for 14 days. But that was actually overruled within a two-hour window, which is kind of interesting. And I just wondered if it had something to do with the AFL, who also arrived on the same day that we did. Whether that would have obviously affected it, and whether there was a bit of a push to say that, you know, everyone had made that trek before those rules were implemented, and they did have to overturn it.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Mm.
Well, the other thing the AFL have done is they've really tried to bolster up West Coast and Brisbane's hopes now, giving them basically home games for the rest of the year.
Yes. Come on, Eagles. They can do it. And it's easy to go down the line of a few conspiracy theories when you get into the details. I just wanted to bring up one conspiracy theory, which has actually made it all the way into our parliament. The conspiracy theory, well, not conspiracy theory, when you look at what happened in the GFC, in the country of Cyprus, where they nationalised their banks, and they actually took people's money from bank accounts and said, "We're actually going to everyone who's got a bank account here is going to take a haircut on their bank account balance." And
I do remember that.
And the ability to do that is there, and it's part of the banking system and the banking structure. But whether it would actually happen or not, I mean, the reason why it was kind of allowed to happen in Cyprus was, firstly, they were an absolute basket case of an economy and system of government. And secondly, I think around about half of their bank account balances were suspected to be from Russian oligarchs and Russian criminal organisations. So they thought,
well, they don't mind having a bit of a haircut on that that money in the bank.
That's right, for a government, and you can do that. But they're looking at whether it can happen in Australia, and there's fears that the coronavirus economic crisis could create an environment where people in Australia have to take a haircut on their bank account.
And when you say in Cyprus, though, Louis, what kind of – how much are we kind of talking? What was the percentage that they took a clip from? Do you know?
I think it was 40% or 60% or something along those lines. So if you had $10,000 in the bank, then suddenly it's worth round about half of what you put in.
I might put mine under my mattress then, if that's the case.
Yeah.
But it's such extreme circumstances that it happens under. And what would that do if that happened in Australia? What would that do to people's confidence? And I just have to say, it's never going to happen. I'm just that confident in our financial system, and even if there was political will to do it, which there never would be, because how bad would that be for voters? There wouldn't be the financial market regulators' support of it either, because it just destroys confidence in the system. But yeah. Anyway, the theory that it could happen has got as far as Parliament. And there's also two specific pieces of legislation to prevent it from happening. And there is still a government guarantee right now under law of all bank deposits for people to hold up to $250,000 in cash. That's guaranteed by the government. So, again, under law, it couldn't happen in Australia for anyone who's got less than $250,000 in cash.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, the conspiracy theory that it could happen has made it all the way to Parliament, and those laws under the Banking Act are under review again.
Yeah, I just cannot see how that would happen. There would be riots in the streets in Australia if that happened, and I wouldn't want to be the politician who, or the politicians who allowed that rule to go through. I just think it goes completely against our democracy and the way that we treat property rights here in Australia. Mm. That would be highly unlikely, I think.
Interesting that it made it to Parliament, though. I find that quite interesting that it was even a conversation. It's kind of intriguing, really.
Yeah. Courtesy of One Nation senators.
Right. There you go.
Okay.
Yep. So maybe another, it's the quality of our parliamentarians.
Yeah. Well, another conspiracy theory that's going around Melbourne at the moment is the talk around the stage four restrictions. You guys are there. What is happening, and do you think we're going to move to stage four?
Rumours are abounding. I don't think we will, but there is definitely lots and lots of talk about it. And I actually think it's pretty clever messaging from the public health system, if it is from them. That's my conspiracy theory, that these rumours, if they're not coming from the public health people, they're not being squashed by them. They're being allowed to continue to flow on from the public health, from the people managing the public health. And I think it's a really good way to get people to take stage three seriously.
No, I agree with you. Yep.
By letting rumours of stage four go around. Because if we'd gone to stage three, then there's still a pocket of the population who might be thinking, oh, it's not so bad, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, and it's, you know, I'll just keep doing going about my life. But if you then let the rumours of stage four go around, well, then people are thinking, oh, well, what does stage four mean? Well, it means this and that, and I'd better take that seriously. And it just creates, I think, a big difference between the initial impact of coronavirus in February and March, and today, is that complacency factor and the level of fear and anxiety which drove people's change in behaviours back in February and March. Mm. And that fear and anxiety hasn't quite been there. It's been a bit harder to flip that switch this time around because people are
a bit tired of it.
Tired of it and reluctant to go through it again. But then you've got when these rumours come out about stage four, well, then it flicks that switch and people move back to that that feeling of fear and anxiety, which is necessary from a public health perspective to get people to take it seriously.
Yeah, certainly some big numbers, though, that are coming through. I think it was 317 yesterday, which was pretty troubling. I'm just hoping that we just sort of start to see a reduction in the cases just a little bit to show that we've turned the corner.
Well, our best mate, Dictator Dan, commented directly on this, I think, yesterday around the numbers and the move to potential stage four. And he was pretty matter-of-fact in saying that it's a potential thing, but he's not seeing it as likely because the lockdown the stage three restrictions that were put in place just over a week ago, he says, have flattened the growth spike. So even though the numbers are higher, they're not exponentially higher. Like that 200 to 300 mark has been consistent. He believes that they need another small period of time to see whether those numbers are sort of containing themselves before they would consider stage four. So he's expecting that the initial measures have done what they needed to do and that those numbers will start to flatten and then drop again. If that's the case, we won't get to stage four. I think it's only if we suddenly see them jump to 600 or 1,000 that stage four will come in.
Yeah, geez, I hope so. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, and that's something which people lose sight on. From a statistical point of view, it's the relativity that either has the public health system comfortable or anxious. From where we are right now, of sort of 200 and something cases per day, an escalation from there would be a doubling of that. So one day of 300 and something cases, even 2 days of 300 and something cases, is probably not much to be worried about. If we have been around 200 and something cases, which we were for 5 or 6 days in a row, look out for it being 400 or 500 for a few days in a row.
Right.
You're looking for that doubling number. And so people are getting anxious about it getting into the 300s. Well, that's not really much different to the 200s. But conversely, people weren't worried enough when it was 10 a day becoming 20 a day.
Yeah, it just seemed, so minor. The numbers, I think when it's 300, your mind sort of takes you away and goes, oh gosh, that's crossing another 100. And that's where people psychologically, come unstuck and feel bad and feel helpless about it. So
on the flip side, though, we've now ticked over 10,000 cases here in Australia, and we've got a death rate of 120 something, was it? 123? Is that?
Yeah.
123.
That sounds right.
Yep.
A low percentage.
Yeah. So the death rate here in Australia is significantly less than what it is in other parts around the world, and we have significantly less cases as well. Active cases and also total cases reported in many other parts around the world. So it's not all doom and gloom.
Yeah, I'm intrigued on the death rate. Does anyone had any information on why it's so low? Is it because we've got such good, such good healthcare? Is it to do with the fact that we're quite a healthy population? I mean, why is that? Oh, we're getting onto it quicker. I mean, what do we think that is actually caused from? Why are we seeing such low death rates?
My opinion is that we've been really good and the community's been really adhering to making sure that the vulnerable people are less exposed than other countries. Yeah. So even though we're getting growth, I think it's mainly those younger people that are probably healthier and less likely to be fatalities are the ones that are contracting it.
Yeah.
And we're a bit more mindful of the older population. I don't know whether there's any truth to that. It's just an opinion.
And I guess our testing has been sky high as well. So you're probably going to pick up a lot more cases
And as you're reporting more cases, and you're naturally going to probably see a drop in the death rate as more and more cases get discovered. Because if you look at other places around the world who aren't testing as rigorously as what we are, they'll have typically a higher death rate because you can measure the deaths, but if you're not measuring the number of cases, then you haven't quite got all of the statistics that you need to get a full picture of what a true death rate might be. And I suspect that if many other places around the world were testing and picking up cases that aren't being picked up, then all of a sudden you've got a much larger number of cases divided into the deaths that you're registering.
Interesting.
The other thing to keep in mind is that, again, coming back to statistics, if I can say that word properly, is the case fatality ratio is pretty unreliable while the pandemic is going on. And when you look at the SARS outbreak, which is SARS-CoV-1, which was a coronavirus from previously, the case fatality ratio at the time was thought to be around, I think it was around 8%. So a higher death rate than the current coronavirus.
Yeah.
That was while the pandemic was going on. However, once they had actually got on top of it and the pandemic was over, they revised the statistics and they got the actual final numbers on it and figured out, hang on, it's actually a death rate of 20%. It was a substantial difference once they actually got to the end of the pandemic. Mm. So the case fatality rates, yes, there's differences between the countries, but it's also something which is just very difficult to actually measure while it's still unfolding.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing I would point out is as a society, we're used to looking at it as a binary set of outcomes. You either die or you recover. And it's nice to think that 99% of people are surviving and recovering. But just in knowing that this disease is only 6 months old and we're still very early in discovering what it actually does and how it impacts, there's now the follow-ups that are happening at 30, 60 and 90 days. Somewhere between 15% and 30% of people have symptoms, major symptoms, for 1, 2, and 3 months.
Yeah.
So this is not necessarily something that's going to put you in bed for 2 weeks and that you recover. There's a really good number of the population that are knocked out for months. Mm. And if it's somewhere between 1 in 10 and 3 in 10 people that are going to be bedridden for a month or more, and potentially 3 months or more, that's going to cause a pretty big rate of sick leave, if nothing else. But also the long-term health impacts of people who can't breathe the same way anymore, or people who can't be active the same way anymore.
I think what you said too, Louis, we just don't know what the long-term implications are. I did read an article too where they conducted autopsies on the bodies of people that have had coronavirus, and in every organ in the body, just about, they had found blood clots in the body, in all of the organs, which is a really concerning thing as well, because obviously that shows that the body is suffocating.
So I just think for people who are blasé about potentially contracting it, there's more to it than just the death rate. And for young people, with the death rate being, I don't know, what is it, 1 in 1,000 or something, a very low case fatality rates that we know of so far, there's more to it than that. And if you want something to shock you, just go online and look for support group, coronavirus support chat groups or Facebook groups or something, and you'll hear about people who are still trying to battle on with it months after their initial diagnosis.
Yeah, interesting one. We'll now throw to a quick break, and we're going to be back with our first topic for the day.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, guys. We've now had Joel do some Googling while we've been on our ad break, and he's just going to come back with some information on the Cyprus bank account confiscation.
Okay. Yeah, look, we're just a little correction here. So what happened back in the recovery coming out of the global financial crisis, Cyprus bank accounts, for those bank accounts that had less than 100,000 euros in them, they had to pay a one-time tax of 6.75%. And anyone with over 100,000 euros had to pay a one-time tax of 9.9%. So just a little bit of a correction there.
Mm. On our first topic too for today, we're going to throw over to Brett. Now, Brett, I'm a little bit intrigued about this. You're going to talk to us about the occupancy rate in Melbourne CBD of the rental market. Can you tell us more about that? It seems to be increasing or growing.
I can go into a bit more detail. Yeah, look, I want to change the format a little bit of my weekly segment here. There's some data that I look at that's cyclic or comes on a regular basis, such as the amount of market activity, clearance rates, those sorts of things. So I thought for regular listeners, I might just do a weekly update as an introduction to the property section I talk about, and then get into a broader topic after that. So why don't I just quickly touch first of all on some market activity that we're seeing for the week. So
that's good.
First one I wanted to touch on, pre-listing activity helps us indicate or get an indication of how many properties are likely to come to market and what buyers and sellers are thinking about the market. So this is an indicator of how many people are starting to look and speak to the selling agents about listing their property. Now, this week across the country, it was down just around 2.5%, but on an annual basis, it's down nearly 14% on where it was this time last year. So it shows there's a lot less people looking to enter the market than would typically be, and we know that's really due to COVID-19. That translates typically into actual listings. So that's just the activity that leads to listings. The actual new listings is down more than that. It's down over 7.5% for the week. But on a monthly basis, it's up 9% from the previous month. Now, that's influenced by COVID-19 and people's uncertainty about restrictions and ability to actually hold auctions and different things. So that's always going to be a moving target. So we'll continue to update that on a weekly basis. The other piece of information that I thought was interesting this week was we've hit a record high in terms of refinancings being done. So over 21,000 homeowners had their mortgages refinanced in May. I don't know what the previous high was, but that's a new record for monthly refinancing. So in effect, those people are taking advantage of the lower rates and getting themselves a rate cut, which makes perfect sense. But the average mortgage size of all of those is actually around 18% higher than it was a year earlier. So all of those refinancings on average are significantly higher. So whether that's just a basket of people that are refinancing now at higher values, or whether it's indicative of the amount of borrowings people are taking because of low interest, it's probably a combination of the two, but it's an interesting stat.
Yes.
The clearance rates, this is always something I always take it on board with a grain of salt. So there's three or four different places that publish the clearance rates across the country. Interestingly, Victoria's clearance rates, if you look at what Domain have stated, had said it was 46.4% last weekend. Yet if you go to REA, which is their main competitor, realestate.com, they've listed it as 78%. So a massive discrepancy.
Wow, huge difference. Yeah.
Well, there's a reason to, and this is where sometimes you've got to look beyond just the you know, whatever the headline is. So Domain have taken it based on the 418 auctions that were scheduled, whereas REA took it on the 205 auctions that actually took place. So last week was when the stage three restrictions kicked in again in Melbourne, which meant no on-site auctions. So there was a rush to online auctions, therefore a significant drop in the amount of auctions that are actually held. So that's the reason for the difference. So it's interesting to see how two different, you know, credible sources publish their data in significantly different ways.
Yeah.
But across the country, CoreLogic, who are, you know, another one of the big researchers, have said that the total clearance rate across the country last weekend was 56%. So slightly down on what's a balanced market, but probably indicative of the circumstances. Mm-hmm. So coming back to your earlier question, Steph, about the vacancy rates.
Yes.
This is quite interesting. So I'll give you a basket of information here to digest before we have a look at the potential reason. So across the country, vacancy rates dropped during May from 2.5% down to 2.2%. So across the country, that's a pretty low vacancy rate as a whole on residential property.
Mm-hmm.
Significantly higher in the capital cities, which we'll get to. But even the capital cities, they actually declined from around 3.8%. They dropped around 0.2% to 3.8% in the capital cities around Australia. So that's, you know, not a significant drop, but it's interesting that it's actually a decline when everything we would be looking at from the COVID-19 restrictions and people's personal circumstances would think we would be heading into an increase, not a decrease. The specific CBDs, now this is where it gets a little bit dirtier too. So Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane have really high vacancy rates. So when I talked about the capital cities, that's the metropolitan areas as a whole.
Yep.
When we talk about the CBDs, these are the specific, you know, hubs of each of those capital cities. So directly around the CBD. So Sydney's vacancy rate's at nearly 14%.
Okay.
Melbourne's is at around 9%. And Melbourne has a real high level. So you could almost look at Melbourne and South Bank as being one area, but for the purpose of data, they're separated. So Melbourne CBD, which you guys would form part of this data, seen as though you live there, 8.8%. But South Bank is at a whopping 16%.
Why the difference between those two areas? Because I would have been thinking that most people would have wanted to live on the outskirts of the city, sort of more South Bank than right in the heart. So
my perspective on this, Steph, is that when you look at South Bank, it's mainly those real high-rise, smaller-type apartments, and they're typically cheaper in terms of the quality of the property, for want of a better word, in terms of they're reasonably newly built, but they're just cookie-cutter. They're not built with any real sophistication, whereas a lot of the properties in the Melbourne CBD, you know, there's a lot of older ones that have got a bit of class or history behind them. So it is a slightly different market, even though they're very close to each other. You know, you're only crossing the river. I think there is a typically different type of stock that you could classify the whole of Melbourne's CBD area and South Banks.
I wonder too if that's to do again with the student accommodation. Like South Bank would have a lot of students there, and many of them would have left.
Agreed. And obviously we're Melbourne centric, so we're more conscious of what's happening around us. The other interesting area would be Docklands. I don't have the stats for that, but you could almost look at those three areas as being, you know, the three parts that would make up the CBD these days.
Yeah. What's your thoughts though? I mean, as this sort of crisis continues, do you think there'll be more of a drop in CBD areas? I'm just thinking, as sad as it is, a lot of businesses, small businesses, are really going to struggle as part of this. And you know, if we see a fold in people and their businesses in the CBD and less people returning, do you think it will be a less desirable place for people to actually want to live?
Not necessarily worse than where we are now, in my opinion. I think there's a lot of people that are living in the city. Like the vacancy rates we're seeing at the moment and how high they are directly in the CBDs, I think they're reaching a level that's almost as high as they would go.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, that they might potentially continue to increase a little bit, but I can't see them increasing. Like they're not going to double. I can't see, say, Melbourne going from 9% to 20%. You know, it could potentially get to 10 and 11 if the crisis worsens and there's more and more people that have to go and live further out for cheaper rent or move back in with family. But I think the numbers we're seeing now are indicative of what's happening, and I think he's going to be, you know, an eventuation of what will continue to happen for the foreseeable future. So I'd imagine it will flatline a little bit.
Another question for you, Brett. I don't know if you have any thoughts or data on this, but What do you think about sort of the commercial, more commercial leases in the CBD and these businesses that have the potential to go bust? Do you think that there's going to be a lot more, leases on the market with all these closures that they're thinking are going to happen?
I think it's inevitable. I think there has to be. Like, the extent is the bit of the unknown and how we're going to measure it. But I think it is inevitable that there's going to be a number of businesses that just can't survive. They're just not going to be able to meet their obligations, and the owners, you know, probably won't feel confident about employing staff, and therefore they'll have to close their doors and somehow cease those leases.
Incredibly sad situation, though, isn't it? Melbourne, the vibrancy of the city is really what makes our city so.
Well, I still think it's temporary, but when I say temporary doesn't mean one day or one month. It could be a 6 or 12 month temporary situation. I still think that it will all come back once we can figure out the best way to live with or through this COVID situation. I'm sure that we'll get back to the times we had, and the city will continue to be like it always has been, but I just don't know how long it'll take to get there. I don't foresee that, you know, we're going to see a lot of these big office buildings turn to residential apartments, as being touted in the news. I think there will be a lot of vacancies in commercial property in the CBD areas. But I do think over time that will come back around. I don't know how long, but I believe there'll still be enough businesses. We've still got a growing population. People will still need jobs. There'll still be demand for services, you know, when normal activities resume, and those vacancies will be taken up over time. So, that's where I kind of see it.
Good to hear some positivity.
We haven't quite got to the answer of your original question, Steph, as to why are we seeing a drop in vacancy rates. Can anyone hazard a guess? There's one specific reason that we're seeing is potential. Well, we don't know for sure, but we believe this is the reason.
No idea, mate.
No idea. That's fine. Given that, and of course this data was prior to Victoria's restrictions increasing again, but the major reason we're imagining is that a lot of property owners went back to Airbnb and short-term listings as we were coming into holiday seasons and people were looking to get out and get around. They took it away from permanent rentals to short-term rentals.
Right.
So chances are the amount of properties really for lease is still the same. It's just that they've taken them away from being listed as permanent rentals, which would show in the vacancy rates, back to short-term rentals.
I can't imagine anyone wanting a short-term rental though at the moment.
Not now. This was data before.
Yeah. This was a month or so ago when things were looking like they were improving, and the July school holiday period was approaching and people were sort of planning for it.
That must be feeling stressful though. I mean, people that have or own those apartments must be feeling such a lot of pain at the moment with not getting the rent
that they're expecting. Absolutely. Yeah, well, the other part that that's playing into this whole scenario, though, is not just the vacancy rate, but the discounting. There's been a significant decline in rents for both houses and units across the country, especially Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide have declined the most, but Brisbane and Perth have actually seen slight increases.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit
surprising. They've seen increases.
Yeah, slight increases. Yeah, but
what do you think that is?
I think because they were markets that were probably hit before COVID-19 in terms of especially Perth, where their rents were already depressed a little bit.
Yeah.
So I guess just over time, you know, that they probably haven't been impacted as much as Melbourne and Sydney have. And therefore, you know, the supply demand situation in those two capitals is slightly different.
Yeah.
I think you also need to look at where that data comes from. And I'm guessing that data comes from places that are being advertised right now. I would have to think that if I'm a renter in Melbourne right now, I would much rather stay where I currently am than move to a different rental. So there's probably less movement of renters from one property to another, which means a property that's currently vacant is going to be on the market longer, which means the owner is going to want to do whatever they can to get it leased, which leads to greater discounting. So I'm not sure we can read that as a permanent reduction in in the rental valuations across Melbourne and Sydney. I think we can more read that as a reduction in new rentals if you're on the market right now.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, even we were lucky enough to snap up a bargain. We actually moved at the start of May, and the property that we've moved into has reduced their rent by 33% from where they were receiving prior to COVID.
Wow.
Yeah,
it wasn't. That was sort of an interesting one too, because we weren't sort of even planning to move or get a reduction, and it was just that was where they were at and where the market was when we decided to move. But I think that's the thing, Louis. I guess you really have to be mindful of at least locking your rent in for a year if that's the case, because obviously if it rebounds, then you're going to be in a position where you're going to have to pay more and have to take that into account down the track.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess the nice thing is if you do lock it in for 12 months, and then at the end of a 12-month lease, there's at least a few consumer protections in there to prevent excessive increases in rent after your initial 12-month period.
I've always been intrigued by that. What is the protection, and how much can rent go up? If you are renting a place, what can they do if they assess you after a 12-month period? How much can they increase your rent?
Well, Brett might know more. I thought the word in legislation was excessive.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the Tenancies Act for a while, but from what I recall, it's providing you, if you've got a 12-month lease and you renew, so you're not, you know, you're not vacating and moving somewhere else, or they're not getting a new person in, so it's the same tenancy. My understanding is they can't put it up more than around 5%.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting one, though, isn't it?
It is
not excessive is an interesting word.
No,
there was a metric on it.
Yeah, and I'm going to self-correct because I think there was a pretty substantial update to the Residential Tenancies Act maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah. From memory, it was, I think your rent could be reviewed maybe every 6 months, but it could never be increased more than 5% in that 6 month period. So there is a cap on how much you could have your rent increased.
Yeah, interesting.
So if you've gone in at a 30% discount and you continue to rent, you'll still be below that for the foreseeable future.
I hope so. All right. Well, look, guys, we might take another quick break, and we're going to come back after this message, and we'll continue on with Louis, who's going to give us a leadership update.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, welcome back, guys. Louis, you're going to give us a leadership principles update. What can you tell us about that?
I am. I want to talk about leadership because in the current situation, there, when people are firstly trying to get ahead with their finances, their income is the biggest component of being successful with your finances. Under normal circumstances, I talk about leadership and personal development and career development so that you can maybe get more pay rises as your career progresses by being better at what you do. And in the current environment, it makes your job retention maybe a bit more resilient. If you're with an employer who's looking at redundancies or staff cutbacks, if you're the better employee than the person next to you, well, then the redundancy is going to go to someone else and you're going to keep your job.
Yeah.
So I wanted to refer to a couple of things around leadership from what I've been reading lately. And there's a couple of books. Firstly, the book Good to Great is a wonderful business book by Jim Collins. Another one is 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. And both of these books talk about a surprising thing which I didn't know before. And that is that we have a common misperception that people will join a company because they think that company is going to go great places. They think the company has a great vision. But what's actually been found through, firstly, anecdotal evidence and secondly, actual statistical studies and evidences is that people actually first buy into people and then yeah. they buy into the vision of the business. So people will join like-minded people even if there is no business vision or direction. They'll find people that they identify with or that they think are wonderful people to lead in front of them. Mm-hmm. And once they have that good group of people, then it doesn't matter where they're going as long as they agree on what that vision is in future. So people will first buy into other people before they buy into the vision. So what that means for you as an individual is if you can show leadership qualities in your workplace, in your sphere of influence, however small or big that is, well, then people are going to buy into you as a person and they're going to look for you to you for direction for where your little sphere of influence should be going and behaving. So it means that no matter where you are in your organization, you don't have to have the formal title of leader to show leadership qualities and have people look to you as someone to follow. Something else which is learning from leaders that have come before us, there's some amazing examples of people who have faced external pressures. I read a few short stories lately, one on Abraham Lincoln, who was the president of America when they had their Civil War. And the external pressures of that situation when you've got 20,000 people dying every month who you're kind of being blamed for the deaths of, that's a pretty big external pressure. Another one which people probably haven't heard of is a guy called Ernest Shackleton. He led an Antarctic exploration which went quite wrong when their boat got stuck in some ice and eventually was crushed in the ice and sank. And they had a journey of trying to get off Antarctica in a couple of life rafts. Again, the external pressure of the situation, he had 27 men who were literally in a life and death situation based on his leadership. The external pressure of these situations of being responsible for life and death is huge, and that obviously translates to internal pressure of their personal anxiety levels. And that's something that we can all relate to. We're not all in life or death situations, but we all have internal anxieties and internal pressures from what we feel of the situation. And what these people were able to do was step into that anxiety and find the strength from their characteristics or their personality. They found the strength to look for a direction forward. It's a bit like Sheryl Sandberg's concept of leaning in, which some people might be familiar. If you can lean into the situation or if you can step into that anxiety and actually find some strength from it and move forward from it, then that's a really big leadership quality which people are looking for in the current environment. Mm. The last thing that I'll touch on from these other leadership examples is their ability to manage the personal relationships of the people around them. And I shouldn't say ability. I should say the focus on managing those personal relationships. If you remember that leadership is all around is all about people and the relationships you have with people and getting those other people to do the roles that they need to do or have the focus that they need to have, then it's 100% about managing those personal relationships. And more importantly than anything else is what is the mood of those people? what is the energy of the what is the energy level of those people, and how can I influence the energy level of the people around me and the mood of the people around me to keep them focused, in these examples, to keep them alive, but in our everyday examples, keep them productive, keep them motivated, keeping them positive about the situation, and keep them focused on what good they can do for the team, but also for themselves. Everyone is looking for first two things: what is good for me, but also what is good for the people around us. And at the moment, there is a really strong vein of people helping other people. And if you can tap into that, and if you can bring the mood and the focus and the energy to helping all the people around, then you're going to be standing up as a leader and seen as a person who can really bring people together and a valuable asset to the organization. And that's going to make you more redundancy proof if that's the kind of person that you are in your organization.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to bring to today's session.
Louis, I could not agree with you more. I think people are such a key driver of how a business performs. I think that culture is such an important part of how an office runs, and leadership has never been more important during the coronavirus. And I think, you know, certainly from my own experience, it's sometimes really tricky to do that at the moment and keep the teams together and keep them motivated and focused. And you do need a strong leader and somebody that can actually relate to people and, you know, get inside their heads in a way and you know, talk to them about how they're thinking and feeling. And, you know, you really have to judge, you know, people have such different teams and diverse teams of the way they're handling coronavirus. And you really have to be adaptable and understandable to everyone's needs. So I think that's such important advice.
Absolutely. And just to touch on that, what a number of these leaders identified was that they were really conscious of their own appearance. They couldn't appear to be depressed themselves.
I agree. Because yes.
If they as a leader were depressed or in a bad mood, then all of the team beneath them would see it. And for us, not even the people beneath us, because I'm talking to people who might not be managers, just the people around you. If you are a person of influence, well then your mood impacts the people around you. And again, if we're talking about trying to be resilience and avoiding a redundancy, if you're a drainer, you're going to be redundant because people don't want to work with you, regardless of the legal side, whether it qualifies as a redundancy or not. It's people who are good at that side of things.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about negating your feelings because that doesn't work.
No.
But I'm talking through being aware of your appearance and tapping into the mood of the people around you and enhancing it.
Totally agree. And I think it just as a final note there too, Louis, leaders sometimes just need to have that you know, talk to other people as well and just get it off their chest, because sometimes I think having to appear that way and keep the teams together and keep focused and happy all the time, you almost need a release for yourself just to be able to de-stress and talk about what you're facing on a daily basis, because leadership is hard.
Leadership is hard. That's why there's so many books written about it.
It's a great advice, Louis.
I'm getting through them slowly.
Yep, I hear you. All right, look, guys, we'll take another quick break and we'll come back with our final topic of the day.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
All right, welcome back, guys. As Brett was just saying in our ad break, it's the episode of corrections. Brett, what can you tell us about the increase in the rental of property? I think you wanted to correct.
Yeah, so, well, we touched on it when I was having a chat before and we weren't 100% clear, and Louis mentioned about it being excessive and I mentioned about a fixed rate. Well, we were both kind of right, but there's reasons why we're both kind of right. It's because it varies state to state, and it also varies according to whether you're in a short-term or a long-term lease. So short-term meaning anything less than 5 years and long-term meaning over that. So what seems to be significant or consistent in this is that you can't have your lease amount increased more than once any 12 months if you're on a short-term lease.
Right.
But it doesn't have any specific rules about how much that can be other than whether it can be excessive. Whereas when you're on a long-term lease, there's actually the ability to have in the long-term lease agreement, there's four options as to how it can be calculated, which is either by CPI or by the statewide rent index, or there's a fixed percentage increase or a fixed dollar amount increase that would be written in if you're on long term.
What would long term be considered? How long is long term?
5 years or more.
5 years or more, right. Yeah. Okay. Right.
Whereas
and
if your lease
what happens if you believe that your rent has increased excessively, where do you go to get support or advice on that if they do decide that they're going to increase it after 12 months?
Yes, so there's definitely a tribunal in each state. So in Victoria, it's VCAT. Well, for Victoria, the first thing would be to contact Consumer Affairs and get clarity on your, well, I guess step one would always be to just renew your lease agreement and just make sure you clearly understand what the lease stipulates.
Yep.
Because there are provisions in leases to have agreements around rent increases between the landlord and the tenant. And if you haven't reviewed that before signing, you may have already committed yourself to something you're not aware of.
Right.
So that would be step one, is just to make sure you're absolutely clear on what your agreement states. And then if you believe it is excessive, I would contact Consumer Affairs just to find out the best path. And then if you do want to appeal it, it would be then to VCAT.
Yeah. Handy to know.
Yeah.
And just while we're on corrections, a correction to the case fatality ratio of SARS, which is correctly known as SARS-CoV-1, final case fatality ratio of 11% at the end of that outbreak. But right. it was a big adjustment from what it was thought of during the pandemic to what it was finally.
Yeah. Good one. All right. Well, thank you for the correction on that. Hopefully we won't have any more corrections with our final segment. And this is because it's going to be Joel talking about the end of financial year results. So we certainly don't want a correction with this one.
A nice little note to end on for the end of the financial year and for today's podcast. UGC, we've now compiled our investment returns for the 30th of June 2020. For our Platinum Alpha strategy. Now, for those clients who aren't familiar what our Platinum Alpha strategy is, it's basically our core share portfolio strategy. It's a growth-focused investment strategy where we aim to derive returns largely from investing in growing businesses and benefiting from the appreciation in their share prices. We're typically not looking to invest for dividends. If dividends come, that's a byproduct of making the investment in a particular company, but it's not what we're focused in on. Pleasingly, for the 12 months to the 30th of June, for the financial year of 2020, on average, UGC client portfolios were up 8.17% for the full 12 months. That compares to the Australian ASX 200 total return index, which had lost 8.34% for the whole 12-month period of time. So that's a 16.51% outperformance. And all things considered, given the fact that it'd been quite a difficult year and a major bear market had occurred in between, to finish the 12-month period up 8.17% is a satisfactory result from our perspective.
Yeah, well done.
We are pleased to note, though, that our three-year and our four-year returns are substantially higher than that. So, pleasingly, our three-year returns came in an average of around about 19.13% after all fees per annum on a compounded annualized basis. That compares to the Australian Stock Exchange Total Return Index of a compound annual return of just 5.38%. So that's a 13.75% outperformance over that period of time, and just a tick off 20% annualized returns over that three-year period. And over our four-year period since the Platinum Alpha strategy was incepted, our annual returns were 18.34%. That compares to the ASX Total Return Index of 7.02%. So that represents an outperformance of 11.32% per annum over the 4 years since we incepted the Platinum Alpha strategy.
That's outstanding, really. To be that far ahead of the market is great.
Mm. Yeah, very pleasing, and I'm very satisfied with those results. But we're always looking to get better, and we're always looking at ways in which we can improve the things that we're doing. We believe that we've also found another area of efficiency and improvement with the way that we are going to be managing our hedging strategies moving forward. So we're looking forward to implementing those changes in the coming week or so. Really, you know, it has been a good period of time for growth stocks. There's no doubt about that, and we've been a beneficiary of that conducive environment. But it also is some validation for the fact that when you focus in on quality and you have a focus in on value, and you have a focus in on buying when the share price is actually starting to recognize that quality and that value, that very good levels of returns can be achieved in what was otherwise a fairly difficult environment. If we go back and have a look over that four-year period of time since we incepted on the 25th of May 2016, we had Brexit that happened only about a month after we started this strategy. Then we had the Trump election, which created some turmoil. Then we had a really good year in 2017 where we had some very strong returns. But then 2018 was the start of the China-US trade war. And then we had in late 2018 a 25% correction in the US stock markets and in most global stock markets around the world as the US Fed made an interest rate policy mistake just before Christmas time in 2018. And then we had the recovery through 2019 only to end up with COVID-19 in 2020. So it certainly has had its ups and downs, two 25% or greater bear markets during that period of time. So quite a pleasing result.
Yeah.
And I'll just contrast that to some typical super funds. In fact, some of Australia's top performing super funds, the best 1 year performance I can find is not even 1% growth, and that's with QSuper. When you look at some of Australia's biggest super funds, Australian Super is minus 2% for the last 12 months. Cbus Super is also minus 2%, minus 2.73% for the last year. And their three-year returns are not even 5% a year growth. Just as a contrast.
So I guess the big question is, well, where do we go from here? We've certainly seen a decent recovery in stock markets, particularly in the NASDAQ stock market overseas on the US stock exchange. But I guess where do we go from here? And look, really, I've said this a few times, you can't make an assessment as to how global stock markets are going to fare without really understanding how the US stock market is going to fare. The U.S. stock market still today is by far the overwhelming largest stock exchange in the world. More than 50% of the world's total equity market value is held in the United States. When we start our analysis, we always start with what's happening in the U.S. and what has happened in previous instances where we see certain stock market and share price action. Just this week, we've had two studies come out from a group called Sentiment Trader. They are a an institutional research house that, that conducts a lot of study around sentiment, breadth, momentum, trend strength. And today they've come out with a study that looks at the risk appetite index. And what they've discovered is that the level of risk appetite in the United States for investors right now is still very depressed, which is what you would expect, you know, given what investors have just gone through over the past 4 or 5 months. So they've gone back and done a study that takes a look at when the risk appetite is as depressed as what it is, but yet the S&P 500, the broadest measure of US stock prices in the United States, has increased by greater than 20% over the past 78 days. So right now, the risk appetite is at less than 0.5, which a measure of 1 would indicate a very aggressive risk appetite, and a measure of 0.5 is sort of, you know, stuck in the middle, and a measure below 0.5 is looking at a bit of a depressed level of risk appetite. And when they've gone back and had a look at what the US stock market has done over the past 22 years, and we look at the 3-month, the 6-month, and the 12-month results, on a 3-month basis, the US stock market has seen previous instances of this on 3 prior occasions prior to the current occasion. And the stock market was up on average by 10.4%. 3 months later for 100% success rate. 6 months later, it was up on average by, I'm just actually calculating this in my head, by an average of around 12.4% for 100% success rate 6 months later. And on a 1-year basis, the US stock market was up 16.5% 12 months after we see conditions that are similar to what we've seen today for 100% success rate as well. But that's not the only study that can give us some confidence over the medium term. There was also a study done on small business optimism. Now, the overall level of optimism for small business in the United States is not just about sales, but it's also about all aspects of their business. And just this week, it has rebounded to a reading of above 100, which is actually positive. And it's also a jump of more than 10% over the past 2 months. So as their analysis states that even an improvement of 5% in overall sentiment for small businesses has preceded some very impressive gains over the next 6 to 12 months. In prior instances where this has occurred, the US stock market 6 months later is up for an average return of 9.2%. And is up 18.5% 12 months later for 100% success rate. So when we see big jumps in small business optimism in such a short space of time, this has tended to be a good indicator that small businesses are feeling good, and that tends to permeate through into the stock market. So some very good supportive medium to longer term signs for the stock market, but in the short term, many of the readings were quite mixed. And what that's sort of indicating is that where we are today is that we could be certainly seeing some form of a pullback. It might have already started in the last few days. That pullback may last for anywhere up to 3 months. It could just be some choppy sideways churning action. This time of the year seasonally tends to be some of the weaker months for the year, especially once we get into sort of August, September and October. We tend to see a little bit of softness as the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere start to come around. But if we look beyond that, on a 6 to 12 month basis, the underlying outlook for US stocks appears very positive, which should be supportive for further appreciation in global equity markets.
Good one. Good update, Joel, and very polished, I will say there. Some really good results, though. You've got to be pretty happy with your end of financial year, and look forward to seeing what you can do for the next 12 months. And congratulations to the team as well. That's pretty outstanding results.
Yeah, great work.
Yeah. All right, guys, we're going to wrap up with the final topic for the day, and that is you can't be serious. Who wants to start?
All right, I'll get on to one. So a COVID-inspired athletics event called the Inspiration Games, where athletes were pitted against each other at different places around the world, but streamed live to make it look like a race, has led to Usain Bolt's 200 meter record from 2009 being broken. Only it wasn't. After the event, so Noah Lyles, who was the US competitor, looked to have broken Usain Bolt's record of 19.19 with a time of 18.9, only with a lot of uproar from commentators and different people commenting on social media saying that can't be right, then finding out that the organisers had made him only run 185 metres.
Love it.
Oh, jeez. I've got one from the UK where someone has gone to get some drive-thru from KFC, and he's been denied service at the drive-thru window because he was driving a horse and carriage.
That's drive-thru, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's his argument. He says, well, this is how people have been doing it for more than 100 years. And KFC says, well, no, this is a food service organization, and you're bringing a horse in here, and there's a safety issue too. And the guy's complaining how at the end of the day he had to go to McDonald's to get a Big Mac.
They let him drive through.
I was going to say, did they let him through?
And they let him drive through.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Go Maccas.
So, yeah. Of course, there is a PR response. A KFC spokesman has said, hold your horses. We're not looking to stir up trouble. And then they've responded.
Love the response. Absolutely love it. Very inventive.
Well, guys, we are officially the lepers of Australia, Victorians. We obviously, we're talking from Coffs Harbour today. However, we're here a day earlier than where we anticipated to be here. We pulled into an establishment in Port Stephens.
We won't name the name.
Won't name the name of the hotel. Mind you, we have been in New South Wales for 11 days and we got in before the border closures, so we followed all of the New South Wales protocols. But our experience of checking into Sydney hotels has been quite unusual. When we checked into the first hotel in Sydney that we stayed at, we were set on a floor all by ourselves. We were told not to use any of the facilities, and we had to come down for daily temperature checks.
Which I understand. I think that's actually
Is okay. We were okay. We could handle that. However, things took a turn for the worst yesterday when we arrived at this establishment in Port Stephens to check in. We actually checked in to this hotel. Louis, that was the phone call that I had to take. Mini crisis.
Interrupted our conversation.
Where we took the phone call in our room to be told that we were actually to exit the building and we weren't welcome half an hour after we'd actually checked in. And not just that, we weren't actually entitled for a refund. We were told that, contrary to New South Wales state law, we were told that their policy was that any Victorian needed to have been in New South Wales for at least 4 weeks, which, incidentally, wasn't actually published on their website. So, nevertheless, guess what I said to them? You cannot be serious.
And then I did the follow-up to make sure we got the refund, Joel, so that I would handle it in the best possible way. That's called good PR.
Yeah, that's right. It's the last time you walk into a hotel with a Collingwood jumper.
I think they saw him coming. Yeah. But look, it's certainly been an experience, but I well understand, how New South Wales feels, and we would probably be exactly the same the other way. It's just that was a less than perfect check-in process yesterday, so that's for sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, look, you do have to be mindful of these things, and I would probably be a little bit suspicious if I had somebody from Victoria entering my establishment. There you go. But look, anyway, guys, fabulous podcast and great to speak to you today, and thank you for our listeners for tuning in, and we will be back next week to do it all again. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks, Steph. Guys. Thanks, listeners.